You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, July 15th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So this is the last day of taxes, right, Evan?
That's right. July 15th. Because of COVID, this is the first time ever, at least since America adopted the April 15th traditional tax deadline, that it has been moved.
First time it's been bumped.
So that kind of shows how impactful this has been to everyone in society.
And I got an extension.
Yes. Oh, I put dozens of people on extension the last several days.
I filed on time. And do you know why it's benefiting me now, Evan?
Why is that, Kara?
Because I am refiing my house.
Good for you.
Already?
Oh my gosh. Interest rates are amazing.
Low.
It looks like I'm going to get a 2.99.
Oh my Beautiful. God.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So I'm going to save not just a bunch of money on my monthlies, but, you know, a lot of money long term on my interest. But the other thing is that I'm going to get a little bit of upfront relief because when you refi, usually you don't have to pay one or two payments while you're moving over from one mortgage company to the next. So you have this, I mean, it ends up at the back end of your mortgage, but it gives you a little bit of relief during this like amazing, you know, time of COVID where a lot of us don't have income.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Kara, do you have great credit?
I have amazing credit.
Yeah.
Why am I not surprised?
Especially street credit.
And and some good street cred on top of that. You know that calculates in, right? That's like in the algorithm.
Hell yeah. Well, if it's not, it should be.
Well, listen, we have to start with some sad news at the top of the show, unfortunately. Grant Imahara died a few days ago. He was 49. He was probably best known for his role on Mythbusters. I also knew him from he played Sulu on Star Trek Renegades. I don't know if you guys knew that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And worked behind the scenes in a lot of Hollywood movies. Like he operated R2-D2 in the Star Wars prequels, and worked on The Matrix and other movies as well. Very sad. It looks like he just had an aneurysm in his brain. It blew and he dropped dead.
From what I hear, he was hospitalized. I think it was like a couple days previous, so everybody was really holding out hope, and I just don't think he ever woke
up. Yeah.
And it's been a really big blow. You know, I didn't know Grant really, really well, but you know, he sort of like was very close to a lot of the people that I'm also close to. So we had overlapping friend groups. Just a lot of my friends who were really close to him are just devastated. Obviously, his fiance is devastated. I have a lot of friends who were just doing Zoom game nights with him like the week before he died. And I was kind of, you know, feeling sentimental and going through some of my old messages, like DMs and texts and things. Grant was like supportive of me and my work way back in my HuffPost days.
Yeah.
And when I brought that up to some of my friends, they were saying, oh my gosh, same for me. He was like the most supportive and warm and loving person in this industry. Like there was nothing Hollywood about him. And I think that's why there's just such a collective sadness right now at his loss, because not only did he shine on camera and behind the camera, but he was just a through and through really good guy.
Yeah, just a good guy, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, really sad. And this is one of those things that just strikes without warning, usually. Mm-hmm. And it's if it's a bad bleed, it's always catastrophic, you know. Sometimes, I didn't realize he was in the hospital for 2 days.
I'm not sure if it was a full 2 days, but I definitely know he was there. And I think probably non-responsive before.
Close friend of mine passed away from the same thing. Again, like 49, 50 is a few years ago.
Jeez.
And she was found by her son. You know, just never made it to the hospital. Probably was dead before she hit the floor kind of thing, you know.
Are aneurysms usually congenital or can they develop over the lifespan?
Both. There is a congenital type of aneurysm. Berry aneurysms can be have a genetic predisposition. So we always ask for that family history. But you can get them without a family history, you know, different kind. It's just not genetic, just a weakening of the vessel wall. It expands out and, you know, it could leak and give you a bad headache and then you find it and cure it, or it could just blow completely.
How do they cure it? Do they burn
always
it?
Always catastrophic. They right. could either clip it or coil it. Those are the two primary things. You know, you could either like put like a clip like at the base of it if it has a good base, you know, like a stalk, or you could put a coil inside of it so that it, no blood is going to it. So it, there's, you know, if it's not under pressure and there's no blood flow to it, then it doesn't matter.
Steve, is there anything that you can do as an average person to make it so you don't get one?
You know, treat your blood pressure if you have high blood pressure. Mm. And, you know, if you do get like a new, especially very severe headache, most people wouldn't ignore that, but don't ignore it. But yeah, if you're just somebody who has no family history, no warning symptoms, you know, we call like a sentinel bleed. It's like a warning before it happens. If you don't have anything like that, it could strike without any warning, just bad luck. And it's just like this, like a bolt of lightning out of the blue.
Yeah. And Steve, is the actual cause of death then technically a stroke? I feel
no.
like there's some misunderstanding around aneurysm. Like people say they died of an aneurysm, but it's really that the aneurysm burst.
You died of a ruptured aneurysm.
A ruptured,
The aneurysm is the outpouching in the artery. And
it's
they
like
could
the
occur,
malformation.
Yeah, it's the malformation. It's, it can occur in places other than the brain. The brain is where mm-hmm. you know the most catastrophic ones occur. Abdominal aortic aneurysms are also very severe because that's your aorta. You know, if that blows, you bleed to death, basically. Mm-hmm. But in the brain, it's the pressure. You know,
the pressure.
Yeah, it just causes your brain to herniate. It just basically squeezes your brain out the bottom of your skull.
I see.
And then you just stop breathing. You know, because that type of herniation occurs, you just stop breathing.
And this is why I don't like. Now, I'm not joking. You know, like the idea that your brain is pulsing like that. Mm-hmm. It just scares me. Okay,
there. No, it but is. That means it's alive. That's a good thing if your brain is pulsing.
Your whole body's pulsing. Sign. You know,
exactly. Steve, is there any way to detect it?
Oh yeah, I mean, if you had an MRI, you would probably see it. Or
the problem is they can happen
CT
fast,
angiogram
right?
or MR angiogram. You know, like the rupture rate is something like 1% per year. So you probably, depending on exactly the size and type and everything, but so yeah, you can go for years with one. You know, you could have one right now. You know, you'd never know it.
Jeez. You wouldn't know.
Yeah, so it is. I mean, it's sad, right? When we hear, I mean, anytime we lose somebody who we love, anytime we lose somebody who really touched a lot of lives, it's a really difficult time. I think there is this kind of, I don't know what it is, but this exacerbation, I guess, of the tragedy when it feels so capricious, like so random and so quick, and nobody expected it, nobody saw it coming. He was young, he was healthy, and kind of in the prime of his life.
There's
so.
An element of injustice to it that is
absolutely
very uncomfortable.
Yeah, but in essence, you know, I think it speaks to what I'm often promoting on the show, what I'm researching for my PhD, this idea that, you know, we really got to live like there is no tomorrow because we it's just not guaranteed.
Yeah. And there's 100 ways this could happen, right? You can get into a car
totally.
Accident, you know.
Totally. So having that just understanding of the fact that we are mortal and that our lives will come to an end, and sometimes quite suddenly, means that, make sure that we, you know, live and love today.
Carpe diem.
Yeah.
Carpe diem.
Yeah, exactly.
Definitely.
So speaking of which, let's talk about COVID a little bit before we move on to our news items.
Yep.
So the numbers, of course, only getting worse. And of course, the U.S. is a big focus because the U.S. is basically doing the worst of any country. Essentially, COVID right now is affecting poor developing countries and the United States. How sad is that?
Right. You know, well like done, United States. Well done.
Yeah, countries who like don't have the resources to really handle it. And us, because we're just F-ups and because we just refuse to do what we need to do. Yeah. You know, it's just ridiculous.
It's pathetic. It is pathetic.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously showing a lot of weaknesses in our system. It's showing also a lot of difficulties with everything from kind of top-down responsibility to individual responsibility. You know, we're seeing that there's a huge movement of people not wanting to do their part to protect others. But we also see that there's a lack of leadership all the way from the top. And I think for me, one of the most disconcerting new developments is that as of today is the day that the memo went into effect, July 15th, the White House has now put out guidance that hospitals will no longer be reporting their COVID numbers to the CDC, but they're going to circumvent the CDC and send them directly to HHS, which CDC, I think, is a division of HHS, or at least that's how it's organized governmentally. But CDC historically has been the one, the Centers for Disease Control has been the organization that maintains those numbers and also makes them public. So the real, I think, concern and fear right now is that there won't be transparency around the actual infection rate.
Why else would you bypass the Center for Disease Control?
Right.
Exactly.
Like this is their job. Like going around NASA for space flight.
As if all of this hasn't been politicized enough. Let's politicize the data even more.
And this isn't something where, like, it's conspiratorial to think that this is a transparency issue. I think this is coming off of the heels of many comments from our own executive leadership about how testing is linked to the number of cases.
Yeah,
I mean,
it looks
there's
bad.
This lack of reality. You know, it's like, I see my favorite kind of meme or tweet about this, or the hot take, if you want to call it that, when Trump says the only reason we have more cases is because we're doing more testing, is like when people will write, man, I'm glad my aunt didn't get tested for cancer because she might have died of it. You know, it's like this idea that those things have anything to do with each other. No, we're just detecting the cases that are already there.
And now they're going after Fauci. Right, because he's being we know it's about transparency because Fauci's being transparent and he's getting attacked for it. They're trying to sideline him and undercut him. I'm actually
surprised that this took this long.
Yeah,
to
I know.
With
we
kind
of saw this coming, didn't
we? Yeah, but I mean, he's being such a champ. Like all of his commentary has been like, guys, come on, let's like not politicize this. Let's not nitpick. We just need to focus on saving lives right now.
Let's do the numbers really quick. So worldwide, 13.6 million cases, 585,000 deaths. And in the United States, 3.5 million cases and 134,000 deaths.
And if you still think that this is just like the flu, keep in mind that worldwide, I think upwards of 600,000 people die of the flu each year. And so we are approaching that, and that's annually, and we're approaching that with just within just a few months.
Right. In the U.S., it's like 20 to 60, like the worst flu year we have. We lose about 60,000. We're already more than double that. We're definitely going to be triple, if not quadruple that, before this wave is over. And then there may be multiple waves. We don't know.
Yeah. And then globally, like I said, we're approaching what you would usually see in a year. And remember, the numbers are not in for some of the poorest and most struggling countries. So, you know, we don't have large numbers coming out of parts of South America, Central America, Africa. And once we start to see those numbers just snowball, I think it's going to, it's not looking good.
Yeah. And very quickly, I mean, there's some good news as well. But the good news is the science, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Vaccination. So the science is really continuing to progress very, very quickly. And having, speaking with physicians on the front line, we have a lot more tools to treat this than we did a few months ago, in terms of like steroids and remdesivir. I think we just understand this disease a lot better. Progress is really accelerating on the vaccine. You know, it is actually possible we may have a vaccine by the end of the year. It really,
can you believe
it obviously
that?
Depends.
Like phase three, I think they're about to start.
The animal data is good. The early, human data is good. Now we just need to do it in like a lot of people. So it's going to take 6 months to do that, but that's by the end of the year, right? So that's super fast. Of course, we have to hope for the best. We don't know.
Is this vaccine candidate the best one? Right. Also, Steve, what you just mentioned about the fact that we're better at treating it, is that what really does account for the fact that even though the infection rate is just going bananas here in the U.S., the death rate is not quite climbing at quite the same speed?
Yeah, I think so. I think just, I think it's also that, and so in the U.S., you have to keep in mind that New York State sort of dominated the numbers early on. It was all about New York, and that really gave everybody a distorted view of what was going on, because if you look at the country as a whole, it looks like we were really bad at first, and now we're going down. But if you just take out, and I've said this multiple times, you take out New York and then New York and surrounding states, the other 46 states have always been going up. But New York also was definitely overwhelmed. Their hospital system was overwhelmed. They were doing two people per ventilator. And again, speaking with physicians in the trenches in New York, right in the middle of the pandemic. They were like, guys, we're just keeping our head above water. We are not like really doing like full care that we could do if we weren't overwhelmed. We're just, you know what I mean? It's kind of like watching MASH where they're like, just get them in, get them out. You know, they're just survival mode. They were in survival mode. And it's a completely different game now. Of course, the concern is that if some of the states that are really peaking now, like Florida, Arizona, et cetera, Texas, if they get overwhelmed, that's exactly the concern. That's exactly the risk. You get overwhelmed, and then suddenly the quality of the care goes down because you literally don't have the beds, you don't have the people, you don't have the resources, and then you know, the death rate goes up just for
many hospitals are already there, Steve.
Yeah,
well,
I think
over
so.
90%.
From what I'm reading,
capacity.
Yeah. It's already
people
there.
In the hallways. One hospital was over 100%.
Yeah, over 100% capacity.
It's so sad.
All right, so well, you know, gotta just keep our wits about us, keep doing what we need to do, washing your hands, social distancing, wearing a mask, and hope that we'll get the vaccine sooner than later. But seriously, you know, we need to do a better job of fighting this. We absolutely need to do a better job. All right. Let's go on to some interesting news items, and we have a great interview coming up for you later in the show. All right, Evan, tell us about the myth of dog years. This whole everyone knows that one dog year is 7 people years.
All right, let me pose that to you guys. True or false? One dog year of life equals 7 human years of life. True or false?
Used to be true.
I would guess
false
because any, you know, banal homespun wisdom like that always turns out to be wrong.
Right. Well, here's my answer. I will say mostly false. And I'll have to explain the mostly qualifier by the end of the news item. For those of you who are so out of touch with modernity, I envy you for not knowing that people casually kick around the notion that you need to only multiply your dog's age by 7, and that's how old they are in human years. So a 4-year-old dog is similar in physiological age to a 28-year-old person, right? Not really.
It assumes a linear relationship.
It does. Where is it correct to make that assumption? I mean, was there a time in your lives when you thought maybe that was true? I mean, besides being a child and hearing it as a kid.
Maybe like in the middle years it makes sense, but it probably doesn't hold true at the beginning of their life or at the end of their life.
And that's a good point, Kara, because if anybody were to stop and think about it, but it's not like some critical piece of data that we need in our day-to-day lives. It really flies below the radar. It's more like a piece of trivia. You don't have to devote brain power to it. But if you were to take the slightest pause, pun intended, to devote a few seconds of thought, that balloon would puncture pretty quickly. Because, all right, at what age can a dog have pups?
Oh, right. It would be way too young in
4
human
to
years.
6 months is for some dogs for some reason. So right there, that's it. The 1-7 ratio does not work at all. That's pretty much right out of the gate. But here's the actual news item. A new study by researchers at University of California, San Diego School of Medicine have come up with a formula to accurately compare the ages of humans and dogs. The formula is based on the changing patterns of methyl groups in dog genomes compared to the changes in patterns in methyl groups of human genomes. It quantifies the chemical markers and where they're located as they age. Since the two species don't age at the same rate over their lifespans, lo and behold, it turns out that it's not a perfectly linear comparison, right, Steve? As the 1-7 year rule of thumb would suggest. This study appeared in the journal Cell Systems. As a side here, they have a very cool domain name for their website, cell.com. That's awesome. When you can have those nice short domain names, I love those. What's remarkable, though, about this one is it appears to be the first study which is transferable across species. Studies have done this before. They've looked at dogs and how to more accurately come up with a measurement of age compared to humans, but only sort of in an isolated respect. But this one, according to the authors, should work across various species. The researchers here are suggesting that it could become a useful tool for veterinarians and for evaluating anti-aging interventions. So it actually has some practical means to it, and hopefully with some good outcomes. The senior author, his name was Trey Eitiker, He's a PhD and professor at UC San Diego School of Medicine and Moores Cancer Center. He said there's a lot of anti-aging products out there these days with wildly varying degrees of scientific support. But how do you know if a product will truly extend your life without waiting 40 years or so? What if you could instead measure your age-associated methylation patterns before, during, and after the intervention to see if it's actually doing anything? That's an interesting thought. That's a very interesting notion. And I'm glad
it's an interesting thought. If you take for granted that methylation is the best marker for aging, that's a big kind of thing you have to take on faith. I know it's one marker, but there are a lot of aging markers.
About seven or eight of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was not all that familiar with methylation patterns before I read into this a little bit, but apparently what's happening here is that methyl groups will attach to DNA and force changes, essentially. And this is normal. This is a normal process that does occur, and there's such a thing called hypomethylation and hypermethylation. So if too much or too little at the wrong periods of your of a person's life can cause problems. So it's this homeostasis kind of balance that you're supposed to have during the course of your lifetime. And Steve, they talk a little bit here about epigenetics as well, yeah. and how that ties in here.
Yeah, like methylation is an epigenetic factor, right? It's anything that affects, you know, inheritance or development, et cetera, other than the genetic code itself.
Certainly the authors like the idea of comparing, you know, dogs to humans, not only because it kind of tried to put to rest the age-old myth, which you never will. It's an unsinkable rubber duck as far as I'm concerned. But in any case, they talk about how closely dogs live with us and, you know, more than really any other animal, that especially domestic animal. I mean, they've been part of human lives for, what, 40 to 50,000 years? So they're exposed to all the same things that we are, environmental, chemical exposures, these sorts of things, all similar to humans. And I read this, they receive nearly the same levels of health care. So we care a lot about our dogs in that regards, right, Kara? We were just talking about that offline, in fact.
Yeah, interestingly. And you also see, Evan, I've seen some literature to show that like obesity rates in dogs are often reflective of obesity rates in their owners.
Ooh.
So there are some genetic factors that are going to lead to that, but also
clearly behavioral.
Behavioral things seem to kind of mimic between dog parents and dog babies.
Despite the myth, and it most certainly is a myth, the authors do claim that veterinarians will use the 1-to-7 ratio to determine the dog's physiological age, and you know, just as a general guideline. So that's kind of how saturated in the culture it sort of has become, and there is sort of a historical story to it, which we won't get into now, as to why that's the case. It basically came down to a marketing, advertising, people bringing their pets get your pet checked up, you know, every so years, because 1-to-7, go see your vet. Mm. So they think it was like a marketing strategy, basically. And when the results came back, so what can you graph? What can you see here as far as the dogs and the humans? The comparison is not a ratio, certainly not that 1-to-7 straight linear ratio over time. It's very, very accelerated for dogs in the early years. And a 1-year-old dog is similar to a 30-year-old human.
Holy crap, really?
But a 4-year-old dog is similar to a 52-year-old human. So you got this steep, steep incline at the very beginning of the dog's first year, and then it starts to tail off, pun intended.
But again, that's based on this methylation marker for age.
If you're going to use this.
It's not behavioral, because a 1-year-old dog, yes, might be capable of having puppies, but a 1-year-old is also still a puppy. It has puppy behaviors.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree.
Sometimes they're not even housebroken. Like, what kind of a 30-year-old is having a hard time with potty training?
Well, some of them, you know.
So, yeah, it's still not perfect in my book.
And it's different for different breeds, because the toy breeds are like puppies for 3 years.
Yeah,
absolutely. Size of the dog matters. Yeah.
And they also live longer, yeah, toy breeds,
yep.
Or maybe not toys, but yeah, smaller dogs.
Dog
and you're
size.
Right, Kara, the neurological age could be different than biological age, could be different than fertility age.
Fertility, which has long been a weird way that we like to measure maturity.
Not only is the relationship not linear, there may not be, you know, an actual direct correlation. Like a 1-year-old dog may not correlate to any human age.
Right.
Right.
The mixture of features is unique to the dog's developmental life cycle.
And so I thought of that as well, Steve, and I was thinking perhaps this is just some sort of, you know, anthropomorphizing of dogs, because that's what humans are good at. We love attributing these human qualities to things that are not human. We just do it all the time with lots of different things. So perhaps right. some of that is coming into play here as well. But as I alluded to earlier, and I said I would wrap up with this about my mostly qualifier, when I said the answer was mostly false, it's because if that curve at some point, that 1 year of a dog's life would equal roughly 7 human years of life. It's just not in the beginning and not at the end. It's somewhere in one of its middle
years. The lines cross at some point.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks, Evan. So, thanks. Jay, tell us how we're going to fight climate change with rock dust.
What?
Yeah, rock dust. Why, you never heard of it?
No, I like it. I love rock dust.
I lick it.
All right, so we need to combat global warming. Everybody knows that.
Agreed.
We need to reduce our use of fossil fuels. Agreed. That seems pretty straightforward. We also need to have multiple ways to remove CO2 from the atmosphere, right? It's not just stop putting CO2 in the atmosphere. We want to actively remove it from the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And it was about a year ago we heard how, you guys remember this, you know, how they were growing trees or planting forests would reduce the amount of carbon because the trees would capture carbon as they grow. So a forest.
Yeah, but we'd have to plant like so many.
Yeah, a trillion trees.
Sure. Yeah. But still, it's something that can be done. And it would capture a certain amount of carbon and hold it there for as long as the forest was there. So when we do burn fossil fuels in power plants, we need to pull the CO2 out of the exhaust before it's released into the atmosphere. That's something that we can do today. That's something that we should be doing everywhere. You know, these are the types of things that we need to make mandatory. The fact is that there are tons of new technologies that are being developed right now, but there's a method we've known about for some time, and it could help a lot. And that's what Steve said. So we could mix crushed rock on farmland, right? So when I say crushed rock, it could be pulverized even to dust. Actually, the smaller the particles, the better. So a study on this was done by David Beerling, where he estimates how much carbon could be captured by this method and the costs involved. So let me explain to you why this would work. So certain minerals in rocks, when they're exposed to both weather and to CO2, they can convert the CO2 in the air into bicarbonate that gets dissolved in water. And this could go into the groundwater or find its way into the ocean. And it can end up being also solid carbonate. So either way, this is all good because it's pulling carbon out of the atmosphere and it's essentially capturing it and it's storing it either underground or it's becoming a solid, like a salt, right?
Yeah, I don't think you would want to put the gas into the ocean because that's going to acidify the ocean even worse.
Well, wait, it wouldn't, and I'll tell you why, because we're not talking about the gas itself. We're talking about it being affected by the minerals that are in the rock. So from a geological perspective, over very, very long periods of time, and I'm talking hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years, this process has a positive of effect on the Earth's climate, and it can keep the climate stable, because when the rocks erode and these minerals that can do this with CO2, that can have an interaction with CO2 when water is present, you know, it's happening all over the Earth. And the Earth is loaded with geology that's exposed to the atmosphere, right? Of course, duh. But what we don't have hundreds of thousands of years. So we want to, in essence, speed up the weathering process of the stone so more of these minerals get exposed as the water wears away the stone and nature wears away the stone and more of these minerals get exposed. So what we say, and when I say we, I mean smart people and scientists, what they say is pulverize the rocks into very small particles. And of course, as you know, anything that's in a smaller form will dissolve in water faster, right? So if you put salt in a glass of water or a sugar cube in a glass of water, the smaller the particles, the faster it'll dissolve. So that is basically the physics behind crushing the rock. You want more of the rock exposed, more of it will get worn away, and therefore more CO2 will get converted or captured. So taking crushed rock and spreading it over farmland, of course, exposes it to the elements. The crushed rock will erode, which gives the soil nutrients, which is fantastic, and it also will balance the pH of the soil, which is very helpful to farmland. So there's a lot of good that can come out of using this technique, but doing it decisively, like literally mixing in crushed rock into the farmland. Now, the scientists can estimate what the potential outcome would be using crushed stone by using the climate conditions, existing climate conditions, and having an understanding of each farm and the area that it possesses and its chemical composition, right? So they'll go around and they'll say, okay, these 3,000 acres have this type of soil with this type of pH. You know, what kind of minerals would we want in the soil in order to interact with that particular kind of soil? And also they can calculate the energy requirements of getting the stone, trucking the stone to the farm, pulverizing the stone. What stone is available regionally? How far would they have to be trucked? That's important, of course, because if they're burning gasoline to move that stone from point A to point B, that's a carbon footprint. So now the researchers have estimated that the use of crushed rock in farmland could capture, and this is a wow situation, could capture 500 million to 2 billion tons of CO2 per year in 2050. Now, let me give you an example of what that means. When we discuss scenarios that have a goal to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius, this involves capturing between 2 and 10 billion tons of carbon per year. And they're saying that in 2050, with the way that this could roll out, they can capture between 500 million to 2 billion tons of CO2. There are 4 countries that the majority of this carbon would be collected from: the United States, China, India, and Brazil. The researchers said that the United States and China, if they use crushed stone on farmland, this could offset 5 to 10% of all emissions by 2030. Yeah. India could be up to 40% of capturing emissions, you know, or offsetting emissions, and Brazil could be 100%.
And Jay, is that just because the farmland is so large that you're essentially making a carbon sink spread across just the flat ground?
That's perfect what you said, Kara. Yeah, it's like you have a technology that you're spreading across the massive amount of acres that farmland covers all over the world. Remember, we've said this on the show many times before. We're farming already all of the arable land that the world has to offer, and it's massive. So when you think that you're turning that, you're saying, yes, it's a farm, but it's also going to be a CO2 capture, you know, process. That's profound. That's a lot of real estate right there. So bottom line is they estimate the cost to remove 1 ton of CO2 with this process would be $160 to $190. In the United States, the EU, Canada, and China, India, and Brazil would be more like $55 to $120. So when you average it all out, it'll kind of maps with the existing cost of carbon capture techniques that we have today. So this seems totally viable, totally doable. Now, keeping in mind, I'm not talking about inventing any new technology. You simply are crushing stone. Now, I was doing some more reading on this, and they were saying things like, there's already a ton of unwanted stone byproduct from processing. You know, when you buy, like, I, as an example, for my stone wall, I'm going to be buying, you know, 1 to 2 inch rock, you know, like they turn granite into small rocks. When they crush that, an amazing amount of dust is created that they just get rid of. And I don't even know what they do with it, but it's not used. It doesn't go anywhere. They don't do anything good with it. Well, they could be like, hey, all of you stone processing plants, we'll take all your unwanted stone, you know, crushings, whatever you want to call them, and we'll put them to work. So there seems to be the synergy already in place. And again, there's nothing to really prove here. We know that the rock will do this. It's really a logistical situation at this point.
Jay, I have a couple questions for you.
Yes.
Does the potential shift in the pH of the surrounding area because of this bicarbonate quality have any sort of negative effects on the actual farmland itself? Like, is it going to... crushing a bunch of rocks that have specific minerals in them, how will that affect the ability for crops to grow on that same land?
Right. Well, I think, first off, I didn't read anything negative. I think what they were saying is that they would tailor the rock depending on the actual farmland and the use of the land. Of course, if they were going to introduce minerals that would be negative to the crop, they probably wouldn't even do it. But they didn't say anything about that. And this study was really not talking about whether or not the crushed stone would work. It's more of what are the economics of doing it? You know, here's what the estimate is on what it could do. How much would it cost to do it? And they didn't say anything negative about the actual farming process or what it would do to crop growth and all that. I don't, and I just
gotcha.
Don't, I think that's very specific, and that's probably something that would come later in this process.
Well, it could blow the whole thing up. You know, that's why I ask is like, number one, is this even viable? Is it something that farmers are going to want? Or are they going to be like, my crops suck now? I'm not doing this.
Which would have a could have a net negative effect.
Exactly. Yeah. And the other question I had was really about sourcing the rocks. Like you had talked a little bit about byproduct, which is amazing. But obviously on an industrial scale, lots of times now we're talking about mining or we're talking about extractive processes that could actually contribute to climate change. So why the I get the conversation about like using resources that are already available, but why can't we just add minerals to the soil? You know what I mean?
Well, where do you get the minerals? That's the thing. Because
why can't we synthesize them?
Well, I'm sure that we could, but I think what they're saying here is like rock is a natural resource. There's a ton of it. I mean, when I say ton,
it's in my backyard.
There's billions and billions, if not trillions and trillions of tons of rock that we could use. And
right. same fossil fuels. I mean, sometimes I think this extractive attempt is kind of what got us in this problem in the first place.
It sounds like it works in theory and maybe it will work in practice, but you would need like a real systems evaluation. Like,
yeah, this was done on paper, right? So they're sitting there
a theoretical
pencil scratching going, how much would it cost to extract the rock? What would the CO2 footprint be of extracting the rock? How far would we have to truck it?
It's like a plausibility thought experiment.
Exactly.
Yeah, gotcha.
Exactly.
Okay.
But the wonderful thing about it is that thrills me is that we're just talking about crushed rock. You know what I mean? It's not like this brand new chemical that they have to come up with and maybe with the lattice work of new freaking crazy technology. I mean, it's here. We could do it. They just need to take it to the next two steps to see how well it will work in the real world.
Yeah. Ultimately, right. If we should do it or not.
If we should. Yeah. Yeah. If the benefits outweigh the costs, exactly.
Right. But it's good. We've got to be thinking of these ideas, though, because it could be something simple like this that could, you know, anything that adds 5%, 6% or whatever in the right direction, you know, it could all add up. And especially, you know, if we're adding extractive methods in addition to reducing the CO2 emission, I think that combination is going to be necessary to achieve the goals that we want to achieve, you know, avoid the tipping points. I recently wrote about two different neurological studies that were very interesting and I couldn't choose between them. So I'm going to talk about both.
They kind of
have a similar theme. And I'm just going to be very, very quickly give you sort of the bottom line of what these two different things showed. So we guys all know about inattentional blindness, right?
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have it all the time.
Yeah. The idea that when you're focusing on one thing, you're filtering out other things.
And what did you say, Steve?
Mm-hmm. And we wrote about this in our book, the fact that you're filtering out most of the information that gets to you. Like, you know, me ignoring Jay's question, for example. So the question is, you know, what's the process? How does the brain filter out different sensory stimuli, right? Or at least where in the brain does it occur? So some neuroscientists did research using mice, and what they trained mice to respond to stimulation of one whisker, I guess, by giving them rewards, and they had to ignore the other whisker.
Oh, wow. That must have been a long training protocol. Yeah.
And then they looked at the expert mice, the mice that were really good at following, like responding to sensation in the target whisker and ignoring stimulation of the distraction whisker. They looked at the activity in their brains, and they did not use fMRI. They actually used a different technique. They looked at calcium labeling, right? So they were actually able to visualize the activity of calcium channels in the neurons because they labeled them. They made them glow, right? With bioluminescent, you know, proteins. So in any case, what they found was, here's the quickie, that when the target whisker was stimulated, you could see the primary sensory cortex light up, right? So this is the first part of the brain that just receives the raw sensory data. And then that data is processed and then distributed to most of the rest of the brain, right? But when the distraction whisker was stimulated, the primary cortex would light up, but then it wouldn't be distributed to the rest of the brain. Right, it would basically be suppressed.
So it still saw it, or felt it.
Well,
but it didn't
subconsciously.
That's right. The word saw or felt is loaded,
right?
Because did the mouse experience it. And so that's an interesting question. When something impinges upon your primary visual cortex, for example, do you see it, or do you only see it when it gets processed by higher sensory, you know, levels that give meaning to it and put it into context and then send it to your memory and, you know, do all those other
things.
And
also, how do you define that in a mouse who doesn't have a subjective way to tell you, or right. has no way to tell you about their subjective experience?
Right, but that wasn't even a layer of the study. They just want to know what's happening in the brain when for the target versus the distraction. So it seems like the information gets to the primary sensory cortex, right? So it's like you see the gorilla, right? You see the thing you're not looking for. See meaning in your primary visual cortex, but then it ends there. It gets suppressed at that point, actively filtered, you know, and doesn't get distributed to the rest of the brain where it normally would, where you then experience it, remember it, it triggers other memories, whatever, where all the other higher level stuff happens in response. It affects your behavior, right? In this case, I guess they were trained to respond to get the appropriate reward, et cetera. So very interesting. When you filter something out, when you have inattentional blindness, you're focusing your attention on one thing, and therefore you're actively suppressing the perception of other things, And so, and that information is just not getting distributed to your brain. That's the implication of this study. So it kind of fits with the psychological data that we know that this phenomenon exists.
Yeah,
this
is just now a neuroanatomical correlate.
Steve, so your brain is unconsciously aware of it in the moment, but it's shunning it, and it doesn't go into the deeper parts of your brain.
I would say the higher parts of the brain, not the deeper parts of the brain, to be more accurate. In fact, because the deeper parts are the more primitive parts.
It's lizard brain.
If anything, it's in the opposite direction. It goes to the more recently evolved parts of the brain,
cortex,
where you do more sophisticated processing and where you impart things like context and meaning and associative memory and things like that.
This reminds me, Steve, of inattentional, sorry, not inattentional blindness, cortical blindness in a way.
Could, yeah, so absolutely.
Where a patient doesn't know they can see because they can't visually see. They tell you they see nothing.
It's unconsciously
they
see it.
But if you throw a ball at their head, they might duck.
Right, because the parts of the brain are getting that information, but it's not just like going through the full visual pathway where they would experience vision, you know, like neurologically intact people would. Right.
So it's like they're seeing, but they're not perceiving. Maybe we need a new word for what seeing is,
it's
like a low-level
blindness,
seeing and a high seeing.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, and the other study, very interesting, but a couple layers here, but what they were basically doing was comparing what happens in the brain when you see an image versus when you imagine the image. So it's what's the relationship between imagining and seeing? And the bottom line is what they found was that when you are actually looking at something, a smaller part of the visual cortex lights up, but it lights up in high detail. You know, they did like a voxel by voxel analysis, and they showed that it's a much more detailed image. When you imagine the same thing, you have a diffuse part of your brain lights up, but with much less detail.
Right, larger area, perhaps?
Yeah, larger area, less detail. So it's fuzzy.
Cool.
So our imaginations are fuzzy.
Of course they are.
But wouldn't it be cool if you had like, I don't know, a visual artist do the same, like a group of visual artists.
That was my conclusion, Kara. You anticipated my conclusion. So now where do we take this next? Before I get to that, though, let me just give the other layer here. They first made a prediction about what they would see when they used fMRI to look at people's brains who were seeing versus imagining by having a neural network do it. A creative algorithm in a neural network. And the neural network predicted this outcome.
No way. That's cool.
So it's still,
as a scientist, I might not. I might say that it's going to look almost the same.
Yeah. Well, I know that the same parts of the brain would be involved, right?
Right.
But it kind of makes sense. So like I used as an example, and I don't know if this 100% is explained by this phenomenon, but we talked about this. This is actually part of our extravaganza. Draw a bike from memory. Draw a bicycle from memory.
Right.
If you've never done this
exercise, do it.
Do it. Draw a bicycle from memory. So probably most people have seen thousands of bikes over the course of their life. You may own one. You may have owned one. But you may not. People generally, first of all, overestimate their ability to draw a bike, and most people can't draw a bike in technical detail. I mean, and I'm not talking about minute detail. If they get major functional aspects of the bike incorrect, in one study, I think of like 75% of people could not accurately, like reasonably accurately, even minimally accurately draw a bicycle. So when you try to imagine a bicycle, you have just this fuzzy, non-specific, broad brushstroke kind of sense of what a bicycle looks like, and not necessarily a mind for detail, like exactly where the pedals are and where the gears are and where all the struts are and everything. And so that kind of fits. But I also think that it's very mode dependent. It's like what mode is your mind in at the time? And that's where the artist thing comes in. It's like, okay, and I used, you know, the bird analogy because I'm a birder, which I know I've said on the show before. Like before I was a birder, I would see, oh, that's a little brown bird and that's a little black bird, you know. And, and now I, you know, think about things like beak ratios and, oh, that's a crossbill beak or that has this long tail or a short tail or, you know, that's tufted or not tufted, or that you could look at the flight feathers and even the pattern of it flapping its wings. There's all these details that I was blind to because I didn't have the pre-existing knowledge. And so like an artist, when an artist sees something, do they see the world with an artist's eye where they're looking at the details they would need to draw it, for example, or to duplicate it artistically? And so if you attend to those details, then you do notice and do remember them. It does become part of your internal model of what it is. But I think we notice a lot less than we think.
Sure.
You're right. In a way, this entire paradigm is a function of sustained and repeated attention.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we're just trying to draw up in our imagination anything, it's going to be fuzzy compared to the real thing. But depending on who we are and what we do, the more you look at something and attend to something and understand all the details, the more you might be able to draw it up in a really almost photorealistic way.
Right, right. So in a lot of very meaningful ways, and this is just showing again the neuroanatomical correlates, you see what you believe or you see what you know.
Right.
You see with the eyes that you have based upon your knowledge. All right, so Bob, how come we care about optimizing a part of the spectrum that we don't even use?
To me, it's kind of like a lonely part of the electromagnetic spectrum. It's called terahertz radiation, and it may see a new life as researchers develop new techniques and technologies to overcome the hurdles that up to now have hampered our ability to take advantage of it. So this is from researchers at Tokyo University of Agriculture and Technology, led by associate professor and terahertz wave engineer Takahito Suzuki. So this is exciting to me, especially not only because I'm just endlessly fascinated by the electromagnetic spectrum, but because it brings to attention a part of the spectrum that even I forget about from time to time. Now, I searched for EM spectrum and looked at images that came up, and I stopped after a dozen, and they listed what we would all think of as conventional segments of the EM spectrum: radio waves, microwaves, infrared, visible, ultraviolet, X-rays, and gamma rays. I mean, I've said them many times. I mean, that, you know, those are the major parts.
One might say you've bombarded us with those, Bob.
But there's, you know, it's kind of arbitrary, but terahertz radiation or T-rays or T-waves or submillimeter waves or T-lux. I mean, it's got lots of names.
He doesn't have to call me Johnson.
Oh, my gosh, Steve, you dusted that one off?
Right. No,
how could that's got whiskers on it. Oh, my gosh.
So the frequency of T-waves.
Kara's lost.
I think I'm just going to call them T-waves. The frequency range is roughly from 100 gigahertz to 10 terahertz, and it corresponds to wavelengths somewhere between 0.03 millimeters and 3 millimeters. So it's kind of like big waves.
So is it on the far end? Like, where does it fit?
Yeah, so it goes radio, microwave, then terahertz, then infrared.
Oh, okay.
And then visible, and then visible light. Wait, so it's kind
why
of...
Why doesn't it show up?
It's everywhere. I mean, it's
no, I mean, you know, on all of our charts.
Because you could consider them kind of part of, you know, really the microwaves and infrared radiation. And it's relatively new. And part of the reason is why we haven't really taken advantage of it like we have the other parts of the spectrum. And we're going to find out why. So the names for all the parts of the spectrum may seem somewhat arbitrary, since they're ultimately all the same thing, right? They're all photons. They're all oscillating electric and magnetic fields at right angles to each other. Typically, though, the different parts of the spectrum are created by different types of natural or artificial processes, and they have different properties. So that's why they have different names, because they're very, very different depending on what you want to do with them. So T waves, like I said, fall between infrared and microwaves, and they have some characteristics of both. For example, it's like microwaves in that it can go through a bunch of materials like clothing, paper, cardboard, plastic, wood, but it can't go as deeply as microwaves, however. And like infrared, it can't go well through clouds or smoke, and it won't go through metal or water. They're also non-ionizing, which is really cool. And that makes it attractive as a potential partial replacement for X-rays, right? If you could use some sort of technology.
Won't damage the cells, right?
Unfortunately, I mean, it's longer wavelength, right? So therefore, it's lower res. So we would need some software to up the resolution. And I did come across some research showing that it could do some stuff to the body that we might not want it to do. But I think that research might have been a little bit old. I'm not sure what the cutting edge is saying about T-waves now regarding that.
Can they heat up our food, Bob?
No.
Oh wait, they don't penetrate water. You just said.
Yeah. So, but there are things that they can do. But so you may be thinking, well, that's cool. What's the problem? Why don't we just have our terahertz laser pens by now? You know, where is that stuff, right?
Serious,
and the reason
serious.
We don't is because of the terahertz gap.
Oh my God!
The terahertz gap, and it's interesting.
Steve, say
it. It's interesting. We are, you know,
we can't have a terahertz gap.
Thank you, Jay.
So in a lot of ways, we're masters of light, right? Radio waves, X-rays, visible light. Think about it. We can create them. We can manipulate them. We could use them. We could take advantage of them in so many ways, but not terahertz waves. So that's because the way we generate and modulate radio waves and microwaves, for example, is not easily transferable to terahertz waves. So conventional optics just won't cut it. We just can't like tweak them and use them on terahertz waves. We need new types of devices and methods to do that. And we've made progress in the past 10 years or so, but the technology is still in its infancy compared to the other devices we have to manipulate the other parts of the spectrum. So that's the essence of the terahertz gap. It's very difficult to deal with it and use it. So the technology is lagging far behind the other devices that we have. I see in my notes this week, it says, what's the new thingy? So the new thingy in this news item is the use of a metamaterial as an optical component to mitigate this terahertz gap. So that's kind of the meat of this news item. So the metamaterial, we've discussed it a few times before. It's essentially special nanostructured human-made material that does not occur in nature and can interact with light in novel ways. So in this case, the type of metamaterial that these researchers created, it's a type of a collimator that's used to narrow beams or waves. So usually something like that would consist of a naturally occurring materials like a curved lens, right, or something. And we've used them in the past to manipulate terahertz waves, but they're big and they're unwieldy and they're very three-dimensional. So what the researchers did was they created a super thin collimator, just 2.2 microns wide. Now, micron is super tiny. Take a millimeter, right? Imagine a millimeter. Divide that by 1,000. That's a micron. Really tiny. This is only like 2.2 of those wide. So the new collimator is made up of this metamaterial, and the way it interacts with light has nothing to do with the material it's made of. I mean, if it was made of wood, plastic, metal, it really would be irrelevant. It has to do with the way the tiny patterns of it are arranged. And it's arranged in such a way that it bends light like almost nothing in nature can do. So that's why they call it a metamaterial. It goes beyond any natural material. So it's more specifically, this metamaterial has a very extremely high refractive index, which is a measurement of how slow light travels through it, right? Light doesn't travel at the same speed through all materials. And it also has a very low reflectance, which is the percentage of light reflected after striking a surface. Even more specifically, it's designed so that the refractive index increases from the outside to the center of the device, right? Concentrically. So concentrically, as you get closer to the center, the refractive index increases. So Associate Professor Takehiro Suzuki said that the Metasurface design is unprecedented, delivering a much higher performance that should accelerate the development of a wide range of applications, including next-generation wireless communications, 6G and 7G, and even thermal radiation control devices. So what are we going to see in the future potentially with this? Suzuki said, 6G and 7G, maybe even 7F. Are only the tip of the iceberg. Of course, that's a massive joke. Security systems, art history, medicine are just some of the obvious potential applications.
What did you say about thermal regulation?
Yes, Suzuki said that we could potentially use it as thermal radiation control devices.
Thermal radiation control. So yeah, you mean like personal heaters or personal
air
conditioners?
Or mitigators. Yeah, I don't know. Different ways to interpret that, but that sounds fascinating, doesn't it? So for security, I think we're even seeing this now with terahertz waves, but it's like I said, they're probably bulky and expensive and big. You could use it for security to uncover concealed weapons on a person remotely. And this could also be extremely helpful because when you look at certain interesting materials using terahertz detectors, these materials can have very a unique fingerprint. So if you see it, you could say this type of explosive or this type of weapon, it would stand out like a sore thumb. So that could be very helpful for that type of security. And this one was interesting. Art historians and museums could love these types of devices because imagine you had a cheap portable tool for investigating, and looking at the interiors of things like mummies and paintings. And there's also no radiation risk to the user or to the art itself. So, yeah, I think this is one of these things that we're going to see potentially explode in the next, say, 5, 10, 15 years. And as usual, I think we'll see some applications that we just never even anticipated, even at this stage. But so interesting. And I just loved exploring this unrecognized, portion of the electromagnetic spectrum that not too many people know about.
All right. Thank you, brother.
Surely.
Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, guys, last week I played this noisy. Wow, just keep going.
Yeah, long one.
All right, guys, so what was that?
A Rube Goldberg machine.
Something, yeah, something mechanical.
Like some kind of ball bearing bouncing around something.
Something was dropping or falling down something else.
I agree, Steve. That's what I heard when I first heard it. Anthony Kiefer wrote in and said, "Hey, Jay, this week's noisy is a pirate sharpening his sword on a spinning stone wheel." Yar. Exactly. No, that's not correct. But the basic idea, a lot of people wrote in some type of grinding stone or whatever. A lot of people heard that in there. That's not what it is. Next person, Jorn Loken said, "Hi from a longtime listener from Norway. This sounds like the filing of a spare key in a duplicator."
Oh, I hate that sound.
Ooh, it does sound like that.
Grinding metal sound.
Oh, but
it's
like piercing usually.
Yeah, there is a particular sound that metal makes when it's being grind away like that. Now, that wasn't it, but there might be, something in there that, maybe there is some type of metal grinding. I'd actually have to ask the person that sent the noisy in. There's another person that guessed. Her name is Serene Edwards, and she said, "Hi, I think this week's noisy is an anchor being raised and stowed on a ferry."
Interesting. Oh, that's got that roller coastery, chain link.
I like that
vibe
answer
to it.
And more importantly, she said, "My daughter says hi, Uncle Bob."
Hi.
Uncle Bob.
Hi.
Yes.
He's jealous.
For those of you who don't know, during the live stream, my daughter came in and said hi to her Uncle Bob, and it was adorable.
I've been singing
anyway,
your song.
So Landon Mashin wrote in, and he said, "My name is Landon. I have a new noisy for you. I work in the oil and gas industry in Alberta, Canada. The sound you are hearing is a tool called a plunger traveling up a well bore until it reaches the well head. Plungers help us keep the tubing of the well free of fluid so that the natural gas from the well can flow to the surface. At about a minute 30 of the video, you will hear a distinct change in the sound that is being made, and that is from the plunger arriving in the well head. This particular plunger travels about 2,400 meters for every cycle and makes that trip about 11 to 12 times a day. Plungers are quite an interesting technology that we use to help our wells produce. So that was really something specific that probably most of us have never heard. Nobody guessed correctly. You know, it didn't even come close. I think you'd have to work in the industry to nail that one.
I would think.
So thank you, Landon. That was a cool sound, one I had never heard before. And I have a new noisy this week. All right, I have 2 minutes and 12 seconds of that. I won't make you listen to all of it.
I'm only now imagining all the times that you are going to do this noisy with your own voice.
Oh, my God, Kara.
10 years that we're on the show.
In the car, in the shower.
This one has a very fun reveal. And when you do find out what it is, I think you're correct, Kara. Because
this is like the La La Dog.
Yeah, there's so many. Oh, hey, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so there's so many funny little moments in that 2 minutes and 12 seconds that was sent to me. But if you think you know what it is, please do send me an email at who's that noisy. That's WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Now, I need your guesses and I need any cool things that you heard this week. But there is nothing cooler that I can say right now other than Nexus 2020. My God, we have come a long way in the last 6 months, Steve.
Yeah, I know. I'm really looking forward to this conference. I mean, we ended up with a fantastic lineup. And I'm just excited about all the possibilities of what we could do with an all-digital conference. It's going to be great. And you and Ian have done a fantastic job on the technical end. That's going to be cool, too.
Thanks, brother.
Let's see what we got in store for you.
Yep, we'll see you online. Right.
Yeah, hopefully we'll see a lot of you there. So, guys, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Stefan Alexander. Stefan, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
It's good to be there, but I'm skeptical of it.
Yes.
You should be. Wait till the interview's done.
And Stefan is a theoretical physicist, a cosmologist, and musician, and the executive director of the Harlem Gallery of Science, and also the president of the National Society of Black Physicists. So reading your profile and descriptions of your book, The Jazz of Physics, I have a question for you. Is it your career goal to be the absolute coolest person in physics? I think that's the direction I see your career going in.
I take that question as more of a rhetorical question. I would say the answer is no. It's sort of like...
It's a side effect?
No. It just happened that way because, you know, it's the kind of thing like... If you kind of just do whatever the things you're really bad at, you avoid it. And the things you're okay at, you just go towards that. And you just your life ends up looking like this.
So it's an emergent property, you'd say.
That's exactly what it is, right? And it's like a kind of like due to lots of the other circumstances, mistakes, mishaps in life that leads you to where you're at, you know?
Yeah. So what I'm referring to, for those who aren't familiar, is you play the saxophone, you're a jazz musician, and you're a cosmologist. And your book and your career is in a way has addressed this question of the overlap between those two things. How is, and the title is interesting, The Jazz of Physics, because you immediately think it's the other way around, like the physics of jazz. No, it's like, how does jazz tell us about the universe, right? So tell us about that. How did you come to this epiphany that music could tell us about cosmology?
It was out of necessity almost because, you know, it's like imagine that you're the kid that hangs out with both the cool kids and the nerds, but you don't fit in either camp. At some point, you're going to have to construct a narrative to reconcile your involvement with both or legitimize why you're with the nerds or with the cool kids. And so to me, that kind of what was going on. I kind of grew up in a musical family and, you know, very interested in music. And of course, society kind of, you know, there's a lot of messages from society. After all, if you are African-American kid growing up in the Bronx, you know, hey, be an athlete, be a musician. These are all things that many before you have done well. And so that was the direction I was kind of, you know, heading in. But then I had this natural curiosity for, I was also a nerd, you know, like I was curious. I questioned things like a lot of kids did. And so I had good teachers. Yes, public schools in New York have great teachers, you know. So, and some of these teachers like really got me excited about physics and math and things like in science. And so there was both of these things. And as my life continued on and I realized I was able to kind of do both, maybe more the physics because it would pay the bills. I mean, like, you know, I think one of the things I didn't say in my book was I did, you know, get to know musicians because you're growing up in New York City. So I did earlier on get to see what life would look like for a musician that would become really successful. You know, I have friends that are multi-Grammy award winner musicians or one hit wonders, and they still have to struggle about the next gig. And so I just realized, hey, I just kind of pursued the scientific path, but that music and that love for music stayed with me as it does for a lot of scientifically oriented people. And so at some point in my life, I just felt the need to reconcile those two parts of myself. And so writing the book was kind of a cathartic process of that reconciliation and trying to figure out the ways, for me at least, where those two worlds could speak to each other. I also, you write books to learn things as well and clarify your own thinking. So some of that process was just also about that.
So tell us, you know, if you had to get to the heart of it as best as you can. So what is it about, you know, music in general, jazz, improvisational jazz specifically, or whatever? So how has that informed your thinking about cosmology? And you're involved with string theory, correct?
That's one of the things I work on, definitely. But, you know, I work on other forms. I'm a theorist, so I work on everything that I can.
So, okay. So has that, what insights has that provided you? Were you like any aha moments where you think you got over some problem because of the inspiration of music?
Yes. So that's right. I think you nailed it which is that, you know, the book is not trying to say that, you know, hey, look at jazz music. There's physics. It's physics. No, I wasn't trying to say that. I was saying there are some aspects of the physical world, of physical theories, and the way physicists do physics that has elements of jazz and has and you know, that can be seen as musical or have elements of music in it. With some speculations about the other side of it as well, but those things were clearly speculative. But one key thing I think that to me really rung, no pun intended, that I did find to be an interesting glue between both physics and jazz. Well, there are two things. One is the improvisational focus in jazz music that, you know, in the universe of music, jazz music puts improvisation at the forefront. I mean, you got to know your theory, you got to have your techniques, got to be together and all that stuff. But, you know, improvisation is key. And when you look at quantum mechanics and the way the rules of quantum mechanics work, the quantum world works, right? There's a sense in which as an interpretation, because, you know, in quantum mechanics, sometimes the mathematics doesn't fit too well with the way we perceive our macroscopic world. The quantum world seems to be at, you know, best fuzzy. There are many words used for things that are so counterintuitive. And so there's a lot of interpretive issues with quantum mechanics. So one of the ideas I developed in the book was to think of the quantum world as a world where electrons and quantum particles are actually improvising their way through certain physical processes as a way to make some sort of connection with the way human beings, we humans, might want to perceive the quantum world in terms of analogies or metaphors that we are used to, which is that human beings, we know, we do improvise, you know, at some level. So that was one thing. The other connection is, you know, one of these surprisingly obvious things, but it's, and it has to do with the idea of, so I like to say that, I mean, I teach physics, and one of the classes that I teach is modern physics, which is pretty much the physics of the 20th century, quantum mechanics, relativity, you know, and particle physics. And one of the things that I find interesting is, say, well, what that I was able to teach 90% of that class by understand in its great glory the physics of waves, you know, and the properties of waves. You can understand much of modern physics by just simply understanding how waves, you know, interact, how waves vibrate. And so one phenomenon that I found to be really powerful that is a kind of a glue between music and a lot of physics is resonance, the idea of resonance. Now, just simply put, I'll just say one quick example. A musical instrument, right, can functions because when you try to generate a musical tone or a sound, say from like a guitar string, right, the guitar string basically vibrates at a specific rate or, you know, frequency, let's say. And then that somehow has to, the energy in that vibration has to travel, has to get communicated, right, to your ears. And so there's a sequence of that energy efficiently vibrating sympathetically with, say, the body of the guitar. And then that body vibrates at the same frequency. And then that also causes the air molecule to transmit to your ears. So you have this resonance, you know, this sympathetic vibration where a given frequency or sets of frequency can basically combine together to create musical sounds, right? And it turns out that, you know, Richard Feynman, who developed his version of quantum mechanics, called the Feynman pathing rule, Feynman diagrams, or, you know, the fact that an electron has to travel many different paths to get to the same place. One electron, that is. That's very weird. Or a particle can move at a certain point and decay into two other particles, or two particles come together and create another particle, right? Particle creation. It turns out if you look at the mathematics of that, it is actually a resonance because you're taught that quantum particles are actually also vibrations. So when two particles meet resonance, right? If the frequencies match, it meets a resonance to create another particle, right, that matches the same vibration. And if you look at the mathematics, it's actually identical to what happens with musical instruments. But in my book, I kind of explore lots of different examples of the same underlying feature. And so kind of like, you know, in the book, I was looking for all these different common threads that a subset of the musical world shares in common with a subset of the physical world.
And is math commonly the bridge there, like as you were saying?
Sometimes math is the bridge, but I like to say that math doesn't, there's a good word, you know, speak for. Math does not speak for all of physics.
So is that what drew you to string theory then? Going down, you know, even, you know, to a much smaller scale than even quantum mechanics, you know, the vibrations of these strings apparently is what, you know, causes it to manifest as specific particles. So that's just taking that idea even down to another level, maybe the ultimate level if it turns out to be true.
Absolutely, yes. So it's true that you know, there's a beautiful, like, sort of idea in string theory that, you know, really the universe, everything in the universe is just a manifestation. There's a unifying idea that, you know, you just have strings. And the string is the thing, you know, and the different ways the string vibrates gives this impression of a difference of different particles. But all what appears to be the different manifestations of physical phenomenon and particles are really just one string vibrating at different, you know, different frequencies or, you know, and different patterns, so to speak,
right,
intrinsic to the string and how the string winds or how the string, you know, the internal structure of the string. That definitely was something that appealed to me. And taking that further, I also found that, you know, and this is actually something for the musicians and music lovers. One thing that I found very powerful that I didn't think I transmitted well enough in hindsight in the book, because I wanted the book to also empower people who may think, well, you know, I don't really have the math to make a contribution to physics, right? And kind of where I was going at with my book is that, you know what, some of the greatest physicists didn't either. They had really strong intuitions, and they may have gotten those intuitions from other things. You know, like Albert Einstein and Feynman, they were always trying to figure out clever ways, and like I call it wizardry, right, of grokking or embodying physics such that they were able to bypass a lot of unnecessary math. Now, don't get me wrong. They had enough command of mathematics such that once they got the right ideas, they were able to go back or, you know, collaborate with people who could just do the math, right? But the point is that I found that as a musician, the minute I was able to make a conceptual connection between the music and the physics, I was able to then transport all this intuition I had from being a musician, from studying music, from appreciating music to the physical realm. And that thing is a really, for me, a powerful thing and an encouraging thing, because it shows that, you know, that's why physics is not doing number theory, right? It's not math, right? And you also need to develop intuition and have insight and take risks and make mistakes and know what to do when you make a mistake or when you go down the wrong path and know when to quit. And when you have an idea that you're so attached to know when to give up and change directions and pivot, right? You might get stuck in a problem for the rest of your life. And then for what contributions are you going to make? You need to know when to quit. And these things come from other walks of life, not just sitting at a corner, hunching over and doing a bunch of calculations. So that was something else that kind of I wanted to communicate implicitly in the book. Maybe I should have been more explicit about it.
Mm-hmm. And it also sounds like what you're saying is that if, as a scientist, if you, you know, explore other aspects of just your existence as a human being, that makes you a better scientist, right? Just to, you have to explore yourself in other ways and develop your personality and your ability and your wisdom, and that makes you a better scientist.
Yeah, I certainly believe that. I was talking to a buddy of mine, John Lanier.
Oh God, the VR guy.
Yeah. And he shared me an interesting story. I mean, I've known him for 21 years and I just learned a story from him. So you guys would be the first to actually have this story on record. You know, Jaron never went to college. He had left New Mexico to go to California, which is where a lot of the action happened, right, with VR. But he was also hanging out with Richard Feynman at Caltech.
like you do.
Caltech for other reasons other than Richard Feynman. He was, you know, maybe interested in somebody that was not someone else, and he was out there anyway. And anyway, he said that at that time, now Jaron is not a physicist, right? So you can ask, why is Jaron hanging out with Feynman? Now, Feynman was also at that time interested in computation, as and many other things. So anyway, he's hanging out with some young, you know, a bunch of young people. Feynman liked to, you know, would always be inspired around young people who are not just physicists. And he said that Feynman was at that time trying to understand physics by using his body. Like he would, like, you know, figure out ways of representing tetrahedra with his hands and doing Feynman diagrams by lying on his side and all these things. But very different than sitting down with a piece of pen and paper and doing a bunch of mathematical calculations, right? But this is Feynman. This is a person who is a master of that stuff as well. And so anyway, so Jaron told me that that was the thing that got him thinking about the reverse, which is, how does a human body interact with computers? And that was the germ of the idea that led to virtual reality.
Wow.
Wow.
That's amazing. And also, wasn't Feynman famously really into music? He was always playing his drums and kind of expressing himself through that kind of form as well.
Yeah, he used to go to Brazil and like hang out with the local people and like and try to not let people, like try to blend in with everybody else, playing his bongos in the carnival.
I love that.
And I know you wrote about the fact that Einstein famously would take breaks and play the violin, and he thought that that's when he did his best work.
Yeah, he would use that when he got stuck on something and couldn't make progress, and he would just go off and improvise away until something came to him. Some, you know, really, I guess, going offline, so as you know, so to speak, right? You know, I think we all, in some way, shape, or form, like, we all do this, I believe. I mean, I just have this belief that, you know, we all, like, even if it means, like, you know what, let me just go for a walk, or let me just get away from the noise, you know? And sometimes, if you're lucky, an insight hits you, a breakthrough, or some, you know, whatever that, you know, however that's relevant to you. And I find that to be interesting. I find that to be really interesting. I mean, the neuroscientists need to understand this, okay?
Don't worry, we're on it. There's a lot of really cool research about the default mode network, and there does seem to be an interesting connection between this part of your brain, this network of your brain that's sort of happening in the background when you're not actively thinking and, you know, working really hard and focusing on something and hitting a brick wall. You have to distract yourself sometimes in order to work through those problems.
Yeah, I see. Okay, well, I'll have to continue not going to work then.
So, Stefan, what are you most working on right now as a theoretical physicist? What are you spending your time doing?
Well, I'm working on something. It turned out to just be some, I said to myself, well, I'm working on a couple of things, you know, because I have to give projects to graduate students. So more traditional things like gravitational wave astrophysics, like trying to understand theories that modify Einstein's theory of relativity and what predictions those theories would have for gravitational wave signals of binary black holes and neutron stars, and then seeing whether or not those signals could result in a way of testing Einstein's theory beyond, you know, beyond his theory.
Haven't we tested him enough and confirmed him enough by now?
Gravitational waves, yeah.
Got to be wrong about something.
There are some, you know, limitations of Einstein. It's been confirmed a lot of things, but you know, like dark matter and dark energy is not really well accommodated in Einstein's theory. So, you know, there are things on the market that try to give you back Einstein's theory in some limit, but try to explain dark energy and dark matter. And the idea is now, can you tease out signals or predictions that deviate from Einstein's theory that can maybe say this is the right direction to go in? And is there a way to do that in a way that's as much as generic as you possibly can without looking at this theory and that theory and the other theory? Is there a generic way? So I have a brilliant graduate student. Her name is Leah Jenks. I give props to her. And Leah's done some great work recently. It's funny. One of the things I've learned is that I never thought the day would come where your students are able to do things that you can't do. And like, you're the dumb one. So that's kind of what's going on right now.
But yeah, I think as we've said many times on the show, clearly we need new physics.
Yes, please.
To go beyond the standard model. And as you say, like, you're trying to break Einstein so that we could figure out how to go beyond Einstein.
Yeah, so supersymmetry was invented to exactly solve this problem, but supersymmetry turned out to not work. So we have to go back. It's something I'm working on as well, but this is part of my research. But the point is that it's a prediction. So it's like, okay, if it's a prediction, maybe it's correct. And we're just, you know, there's some way that nature regulates that we haven't accounted for. But maybe it does in some situations. You can produce a huge amount of vacuum energy at small distance scale. Maybe. I keep an open mind.
So you'll get back to us when you've solved all of these problems so we can talk about it.
Next week?
No. I mean, look, I already told my students I expect them to solve those.
Yes.
Well, you'll hook us up with your students then, to fix physics.
Yeah, they need jobs. Yeah, so.
All right, Stefan. Well, it's been fascinating talk to you. You're really doing great work. We appreciate it, and thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, no, and thank you. I really appreciate this conversation. Very thought provoking, and by the way, nobody understands.
I know, we could agree on that. That's good to hear. Nobody understands this stuff. All right, take care, Stefan.
Thanks, Stefan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panelists out there to tell me which one is the fake. And we have a theme this week. The theme is energy. These are all things that we would like to be true. Two of them actually are true. And they're news items, and the one I made up. Okay, you ready? Here we go. Item number one, you'll get it when I read them. Item number one, scientists have developed an organic solvent that can dissolve any source of cellulose at room temperature, tripling the efficiency of producing biofuel from plant waste. Item number two, scientists have demonstrated a solar energy converter with 85% efficiency and project a cost of 3 cents per kilowatt hour. And item number three, researchers have developed a catalyst that can be used in the conversion of seawater to fuel and calculate that it will function at industrial scale. Jay made a noise, so Jay gets to go first.
Scientists have developed an organic solvent that can dissolve any source of cellulose at room temperature, tripling the efficiency of producing biofuel from plant waste. All right, that's awesome. That's awesome. And I have no reason to not believe that some organic solvent could just mow through cellulose. Just wonder if the solvent itself has an effect on the quality of the biofuel after it's essentially, you know, liquefied, it dissolves it down to a liquid. I really see no reason to not believe that. The second one, scientists have demonstrated a solar energy converter with 85% efficiency and project a cost of 3 cents per kilowatt hour. 85% converter. That is the key word in the news item. What is a solar energy converter, Steve?
Converts people, energy?
It would not answer. The solar energy converter with 85% efficiency. All right, so whatever, it's not a solar panel. It's a solar energy converter. So it's converting the energy that comes from a solar panel, I'm assuming, into something else with 85% efficiency. Very nebulous news item. So far, that one is the fake for me. The third one, researchers have developed a catalyst that can be used in the conversion of seawater to fuel and calculate that it will function at industrial scale. Seawater to fuel. Seawater to fuel. Can I ask you what kind of fuel it is?
No.
Oh my God.
It's called seawaterum.
Seawaterum. Seawater lean. Okay. Butane, propane. All right. So what the hell is in seawater that can be used as a fuel? There's some biomatter. There is salts. Fuel. Okay. So the fuel could be a battery. So it doesn't have to be like, you know, don't think of it as a fuel like gasoline. Could be some type of battery fuel source. I think the second one about the 85% efficiency is the fake.
Okay, Bob?
Yeah, 85% efficiency, it just seems much more unreasonable than the other one. So I'll say that's fiction as well.
All right, Evan?
That was quick.
Thank you for being quick, Bob.
Yeah, that was very quick. You may have swayed me between what you said, Bob, and Jay. More Jay than Bob. but about the seawater to fuel, I think we've talked about that before. That one before. The trick there is with the industrial scale. So I don't know about that one. That would be the tricky part because we have talked about energy conversion from seawater. And then the first one about the cellulose at room temperature. That one does sound rather technical, whereas the 85% efficiency of solar sounds more vague. So therefore, I'm with the guys.
And Kara.
Yeah, I don't see why we couldn't have an organic solvent. I mean, organic solvents can be hardcore. They can, like, dissolve bone if they're strong enough. So I don't see why they couldn't dissolve, you know, we couldn't come up with something that could dissolve through cellulose. The seawater to fuel sounds freaking good, too good to be true. I think the operative words in this are researchers have developed one and they have calculated that it will function at industrial scale. So on paper, this works, is what you're saying. But it hasn't actually been put into action. And so I think for that reason, that one seems more reasonable. I didn't know that 85% was kind of really high for efficiency on solar conversion. But since the guys seem to think that that sounds really high, I'm going to go with them because I don't know what those numbers usually are and hope that they're right. So yes, all of us are going with the solar energy.
All right. All right, so let's take these in reverse order. We'll start with number three. Researchers have developed a catalyst that can be used in the conversion of seawater to fuel and calculated that it will function at industrial scale. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Wow, man.
Yay, that's awesome.
You're right.
Yeah, so I'm very careful in my wording of this item. All of the items, I had to be very careful in how I worded them. So the catalyst can be used in the conversion of seawater to fuel, meaning it's part of the process, doesn't get you all the way there. And the thing in seawater that's critical here, Jay, is carbon dioxide, because carbon dioxide is dissolved in the seawater. But also the water itself can be broken up, you know, but that's different. That's not a part of this process. It can be broken up into oxygen and hydrogen. And then if you add the hydrogen to the carbon dioxide, you can get all kinds of fuel. But first, you have to turn the carbon dioxide into carbon monoxide. And that is the step that this catalyst does. Once you get to carbon monoxide, then you have your high energy molecule. And then all you got to do is add hydrogen to it and you get fuel. You get, you know, like,
yeah, man.
Yeah.
From seawater.
So then the reason why this is being researched is because the Navy would love to be able to make fuel from seawater.
Oh, my God.
Right? Obvious benefits there. Yeah,
so they can keep those ships out without having to refuel.
Yeah, but they got reactors. A lot of them, the big ones have reactors, man.
Yeah, I know. You're right. But not many of them. There's a few aircraft carriers and some submarines have onboard nuclear reactors. And those are the ones that could stay out for a really long period of time. But there's lots of other ships that don't have nuclear reactors on them. Okay. They have to rendezvous with fuel tankers.
Oh,
and get their fuel. And so this way, if they could just sort of make it as they go, but of course there would have to be energy. They would need a source of energy, you know, to make the fuel from the seawater. So where's that energy coming from?
Nuclear reactor.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't know, maybe you could have solar panels and stuff. I guess the idea is that it's a good way to store energy. You can concentrate energy. So if you had something that would be a source of energy but not enough to run a ship, but you could make gasoline out of it essentially, then you can run the ship on it. So that's the goal, you know, of this research. So yeah, this catalyst very efficiently converts carbon dioxide into carbon monoxide. That is the sort of critical energy step in getting from CO2 back into fuel. And of course, the CO2 doesn't have to come from the seawater. It can come from any source. You know, you can be recapturing it at the smokestack, for example. And then you could make synthetic fuel out of it. They did basically calculate, because this is always the tricky step. You can do something in a lab. That doesn't mean you can mass produce it. And yeah, so they basically said, what are all the things that would have to happen in order for this process to work at an industrial level? And they found that it could. So they, and you were right, Kara, it's just it's a proof of concept. Not, they didn't actually do it. Mm-hmm. This is a naval research laboratory team doing this. So in the reaction that they're using, the one that converts carbon dioxide into carbon monoxide, is called the reverse water gas shift reaction, or RWGS. I don't know if they pronounce that. ROGS? How would you pronounce that? But they just, it's RWGS, the reverse gas water shift reaction. Then just add hydrocarbon, add hydrogen, you got some hydrocarbons, and you're good to go. So that one is science.
Cool.
So let's go back to number two. This is the one you guys all think are fiction. Scientists have demonstrated a solar energy converter with 85% efficiency and project a cost of 3 cents per kilowatt hour. You guys all think this one is the fiction, and this one is science.
Ah.
Oh, damn.
I feel so swept.
You just made the first one up.
Should feel swept. No, okay. But it is mostly. I mostly made
all
it.
All right, there's a trick here.
They're all plausible. So Jay hit upon it. You know, it's not a solar photovoltaic panel. That would be a huge leap. There's no photovoltaic panel that's 85% efficient.
When using the heat, is there the heat concentrator then? One of those reflective mirrors?
It's a hybrid.
Did you say mirror?
Mirror? It's a hybrid. So it's a thermal energy converter, and then it uses steam to generate electricity. So it generates heat and electricity, but through steam. So most actually, you know, energy used on an industrial scale is actually heat energy, right? It's used to produce heat, not electricity to like light bulbs and stuff. And they reported that this process by this hybrid, they said they use a high efficiency multi-junction solar cells that redirect infrared rays of the sunlight to a thermal receiver, which converts those rays to thermal energy. So it's basically, again, it's because it's capturing both, it's generating electricity and heat. And it's also capturing a much broader range of the sun's electromagnetic spectrum, right, Bob? And so because of that, it just has a massive efficiency.
Oh, man. All right.
And so they said if you calculate it out, this would, a system like this, they said the levelized cost would be 3 cents per kilowatt hour, which is competitive, you know, so that this could be a competitive source of electricity. But for industry, it could be like a double benefit because you get the heat and the electricity, you know.
Right.
And for a lot of industries, it's pretty slick. So again, you know, you never know if things like this will eventually work, but this one seems pretty promising.
So it's all about the assumptions you make when you read these damn questions.
I know. And then, these were all kind of designed for you guys. Like So find the hidden trick or assumption. These are meant to be a little tricky. So number one, scientists have developed an organic solvent that can dissolve any source of cellulose at room temperature, tripling the efficiency of producing biofuel from plant waste. Is the fiction. The fiction part is the tripling the efficiency of producing biofuel. That I made up.
What state of the art?
So, I mean, we have lots of different solvents that can break down plant products, you know, from biomass. And the item that I used as sort of my template for the fiction was one where they did come up with a new organic solvent, and the advantage there is that it can break down cellulose without breaking down the lignin, because the lignin you don't want, it doesn't produce biofuel. That's more, you know, it's again another one of those structural components. Yeah. But we do want the lignin for processing and manufacturing. So you want to be able to sort of separate out the lignin intact and then break down the cellulose as a raw material for biofuel. And that's what the new organic solvent does. But it works better at higher temperature, actually, and it's not necessarily more efficient than any other process. So that's still the issue with making biofuels is the efficiency. And if you don't use the right feedstock, you know, the efficiency can actually be less than one, right? You get less energy out of it than you put into it. But anything that could shave, you know, energy off of the process is an advantage. You know, we want to be able to get from, you know, we want to go through the whole process and have our gallon of biofuel with the least amount of energy input to get there. Although, you know, and again, at one, that means you put in exactly the amount of energy you're getting out. So it's not a source of energy, right? It's not like
a good converter
sucking oil out of the ground. Yeah, it's just you're just converting one form of energy into another form. You need to get more energy out of it. So right now the biggest factor in that is what is your feedstock, right? If you're using high energy plants like sugarcane and you have, you know, access to a large amount of sugarcane, things like that, then yeah, that process is energy efficient. But if you're using, you know, corn waste, not so much, you know, it's still, but then you think, okay, but it's waste, so you've already produced it. But of course, there's other uses for that waste other than turning it into biofuel. And so, again, you have to kind of look at the whole system, you know, in terms of like what's the net effect. But there's a lot of research is focusing on developing solvents that can, you know, break down the cellulose more efficiently. Of course, if you could do it at a lower temperature, you don't have to spend the energy to raise the temperature, right? You don't have to cook it. Because that's where a lot of the energy comes from. That's where a lot of the energy comes, you know, that goes into the process of making biofuel, is that you have to heat it at some point. That takes energy, you know. So doing it at room temperature would be huge. But yeah, I just made up all those details. So this is a tricky one.
Yeah,
a tricky one. The 85%, that was definitely the gotcha number there. You know,
too good.
Yeah.
Well,
all
played,
right.
Well played.
Thank you, guys. All right. So, Evan, give us a quote.
Hopefully, the 27th time's the charm. Grant Imahara.
Yeah.
And I like this quote because it speaks to the spirit of engineering, of discovery, of stick-to-itiveness, certainly the Mythbusters, but it invokes things like Edison and all the other, you know, inventors of history. Who have tried again until you get it right. How many times did he not invent the correct light bulb? 2,000 times until he got the right one. So 10,000. It reminded me of that, and it reminds me sort of the spirit that Grant had in his approach to everything he did.
Yeah, it combines in that very pithy phrase. It combines both persistence, but also like this indefatigable hopeful hope, you know, and just.
Indefatigable.
Okay, here we go again. Yeah, indefatigable. Yeah. yeah, I like it. Very good. Very nice. He will be missed.
Definitely.
Very sad.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thanks,
you got
Steve.
You got it, man.
And we will see you in 2 days.
That's
our time at the Friday live stream. Okay, are you
Which
joining
is yesterday. Airtime. What?
You joining us for this?
No, I won't
be
there
Scotland.
This week, which was yesterday for anybody listening, the day this downloads, because that's like the day I land, but I should be able to make the next one.
Okay. Cool. Yeah, so hopefully we'll see you the following week. For everybody else, we'll see you on Friday. Maybe we'll get a special guest to join us on Friday. Who knows? Mm-hmm. You never know what's going to happen at these live streams.
That's
partly why those are a lot of fun. All right, and until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.